Thanks for coming. So it's going to be about monotones and resource theories. So I think I would like to keep this part of the board for things that will stay. So I will start actually here. I'll start with some motivation, and maybe first I would answer a kind of very generic question. Why should we care? Why should we care about resources at all? And I guess the kind of generic answer to the generic question would be that the resources in kind of pragmatic approaches to science crop up everywhere. Whenever we want to describe situations where there is some outcome we want to achieve, or that we expect, and we want to ask, oh, what are the conditions under which this outcome can be achieved, then we would be talking about resources for this particular task or outcome. If you came to my last week's talk, then you could also answer this question, oh, we should care if we want to make garlic bread, but I'm going to leave it at that. So once we have answered this question, there's another question which is kind of relevant for this talk, is why should we quantify resources? And the answer to that question, I think, ties in to the complexity of the world and the complexity of the interactions between different resources. One reason for wanting to quantify the resources that we want to talk about is to kind of mediate between this complex interactions of resources and maybe some practical applications, and having some efficient ways of answering practical questions. So the prototypical example of this would be probably money, even though money does not lend itself naturally to the framework I'll describe. It is the same spirit in the sense that when we want to interact in the world and exchange stuff, for example, that might be very complicated to figure out how to do that in a consistent way. But money is a way of quantifying the resources we have so that we can actually do that in practically. And one other question I want to pose is why seek generic ways of quantifying resources? And the reason for looking for generic ways of quantifying resources is twofold, I would say. So one of the reasons is that it gives us some toolbox for answering the second question. So it gives us some tools that are applicable in various situations, and those we can then apply in practical applications and actually use those tools. So that would be one answer. And the other answer is that by going to kind of more abstract descriptions, we can find parallels between different situations which are describable in this framework, and maybe also translate results by the way of describing these results in generic way or abstract way. Okay. So much for the motivation part. Are there any questions on that? Okay. If not, I'll briefly describe the framework of resource theories. So let me do that here. So it will be resource theory. So resource theory, for the purposes of this talk, would consist of three objects, at least kind of heuristically. It would be, okay, let me just write it down. It would be R, what I will call R3. and star. So R is corresponds to all resources. So this would be some kind of space of all the resources available. So it would be all resources. It could have structure, but this internal structure of this space is not really going to be relevant for this talk. You can imagine this R to correspond to a process theory if you are familiar with that, for example. Then R3 is a subset of this set of all resources, this space. And this corresponds to what we will call free resources. I will explain in a bit more detail what exactly that means, but let me just finish off. The star structure is going to be an operation in a sense. It is a binary operation, so it takes two resources and gives an element of the power set of R, or in a sense, it gives us a set of resources for each pair of resources. I'll tell you what that means. So these are the free structures. There will be some conditions on them. So for example, this star, we want to be commutative. And importantly, also associative. And we also want this star to have some neutral element, some zero. So zero such that if we apply zero to any resource R, what we get back is just R itself. This is not necessary strictly, but I think it's nice to have. And generically, that's what happens. There's another condition which I don't have space to write here, so I'll just write it down here. Another condition on this set of free resources, or we want this set to be closed under composition with itself. So that could be written as R3 star R3 is just free. And what this corresponds to is that if we take a free resource from here and another free resource from here, what we get is a free resource. So there's some kind of closure. By using the free resources available to us, we can only get other free resources. There's one thing which I didn't tell you, which is important for this part, and that's the, like, how do I define this when these guys are not just elements of the space of all resources? And okay, I will just write it here. Can you see here? This is cool. So what I would define this is that for two subsets of resources, let's call them S and T, this will be defined just as a union of all the elements in S and all the elements in T, and then composing them together. Now a little bit of interpretation of this star. This star basically corresponds to, so for example, if we, let's come here. If we imagine R star S for two resources R and S, what this means is all the resources that we can obtain by combining the two resources R and S. So this would be a subset of all the resources. And a priori, I'm not going to assume much more about how this composition of resources work, but I will give you some concrete examples. I think I will only have time for this trivial one, but okay. So the trivial example is that So this would be example of star. I will call this example star is equal to circle. In this example, we imagine that the space of our resources splits into the kind of basic resources. I'll just call them RS and the conversions. So this will be RCon. And moreover, there's no overlap between these two guys. So this is a special case where we can identify some subset of the resources, which will just constitute the kind of static resources that we care about. And the rest of the space of all so-called resources, but they are now kind of more general, I would say. So this rest of the space would be the processes that can change the resources that we have at hand. So this is the standard example that you would come across, for example, in resource theories of states. Say in the resource theory of entanglement, and so on and so on. So this is quite generic as far as the kind of standard notion of resource theory goes. What I want to go there is a little bit beyond, but let's come here and say what would star be in this particular case. So imagine that we have R, which is okay, R will be in here, and some phi, a conversion in here. We have a resource and a conversion. So then combining the resource and the conversion, I said it should be commutative, so we also have this. Just gives us back psi applied to R. So we have the resource, we apply the conversion, convert the resource, and that's what we get. So I'm being a bit heuristic here, but I think you get the idea roughly, right? Any questions about that?
So in the example of entanglement, the free mm-hmm. resource, would this be like a separable state in the LOCC channel?
So here, this R could be any state, and this psi would be any channel. So then combining the state, it doesn't have to be free resource here, right? These are all the resources.
Right, okay.
So there's a splitting of all the resources between states and channels. Right? So combining a state and a channel just gives you the channel applied to the state. If we want to combine two states, say R and R primed, then we could say that there is no way to combine them because this R primed is not a conversion, doesn't convert states.
Or two channels, I guess.
Yeah. So in this case, like thinking of this example in terms of the star operation doesn't really give us anything more, but I don't want to go into more complicated examples because it's not really relevant for this particular talk. But yeah. So I'll use this example later though.
You don't want the star product to, like, it might mean more than one thing. Like,
yep.
You could have been a tensor product of two states.
Yeah, let me just give you an example. It could be also that, for example, alternative. We could also have that R star psi is actually not this, but it would be a possibility of applying the channel to the state, or we could just keep the channel intact and append the state, insofar as this makes sense in the kind of process theoretic languages. So this would be a resource here in this case, and this guy would be another process, right? Conversion. So it just appends this resource to your process or conversion. Yeah, but I won't talk much about this.
Actually. Just another question.
Yeah, go ahead.
So in resource theory, like when someone showed it to me, there was a notion of states and operations.
Mm-hmm. Like so that's like this case.
Yeah, and you're just kind of unifying the ideas of operations entities for the star operator.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
Yeah. So when you go here, there's not necessarily a distinction between the states and operators anymore. Okay. So once we have all this structure, we can go ahead and define what we mean by how can we compare resources. Okay. I'll try to be quick. So we would say that a resource R is, so this would be ordering. So resource R is higher in the order or more valuable than S if and only if this resource S can be obtained by combining R with a free resource, or in this sense that if we combine R with a set of free resources, we can get to this resource S. So in that sense, these free resources are the ones that we imagine are readily available to us, or in some other way abundant. And then in that sense, S would be less valuable than R. Any questions about that? One more thing that I want to tell you. Okay, this is too low. So we can also order sets of resources. So if we have two sets S and T, we would say that these are ordered relative to each other if T is a subset of S star R free. This is just a corresponding definition for sets of resources rather than just single resources. I will use this later. And one last thing is there a question?
So like in this last definition, I would have thought it would have been every resource in T, or every resource in S can be obtained from T, every resource in T, but the way you've defined it here is any, like any resource in S, right? Because S are free. Like, could there be a resource in S for which S star R free doesn't give you something in T?
Yes, could well be the case. It just means that, so in this case, the sets of resources are of the kind you can see here,
right.
Is that you can imagine this as different possibilities. You can apply phi to R or the tensor product of them. So there will be different possibilities of, right?
Do you strictly mean multi-sets here in the sense that I could have three copies of the same resource?
Yeah.
They have three copies that can convert to those three.
I think that's possibly the case. Or you could, I think there's multiple ways in which you can kind of include that information. You could also have the resources have some kind of scalar element to it. So we can multiply by scalars and then, so I think they could be multi sets. I don't really care. I don't think like it makes any difference. And so one last thing which is kind of important and desirable is that this order and the star are compatible. And the compatibility means that whenever we have two sets of resources which are ordered, then combining each of them with another set of resources, so let's say we combine S with U and T with U, then we also get the ordering of the corresponding sets of resources here. So if this is the case, then if you are familiar with the notion of theory of resource convertibility or ordered commutative monoids, then this allows you to define an ordered commutative monoid for this structure. I will not go into that now, but it's possible thanks to this. Okay. Yep.
I guess you really don't want the converse.
No, I don't want the converse. So that's a property that could hold in certain resource theories. I think there's some name for it, which I forget now. But in general, I wouldn't want that. This just follows from the definition and the properties of Stardew. And OK, I'll just add one more definition in this, which is kind of central to the next part. So the definition is that a subset of resources S is what I would call downward closed. Downward closed. I'll just use DC for that. If combining resources in this set with the free resources doesn't get us out of the set, so we will only get S here. You could also imagine having a subset inclusion here, but if we imagine that this neutral element is included in the free set of free resources, then we can just get away with equality here. Equality is a bit strong, but let's just leave it at that for this talk. Yeah, so this would be the notion of downward closed set. And there are many examples of these. So for example, R itself, the space of all resources, is downward closed. The space of free resources is downward closed. And in particular, also R free combined with any other set for P, any subset of resources, is downward closed, right? Because of the associativity. Okay. So now that's for the resource theory part. I'll add a bit more about monotones here. So now we are getting to the second question, which I just erased, which is about quantifying resources. So monotones are a way to quantify resources in a way that's consistent with the ordering of the resources. So they would be some functions. Let's say a function f, which takes resources and evaluates them in terms of some non-negative real numbers, would be a monotone. Is the writing big enough, by the way? OK. So this would be a monotone if basically if it's order preserving. So there is an order on R. There is an order on real numbers. And we want this function to respect that order. So if basically two resources being ordered implies that their values are ordered as well with respect to the standard ordering on real numbers. And this would be the case for all resources R and S in R. There's different ways in which you can write down this condition. I'm not going to go into them in the interest of time. And you can also imagine functions not of resources, but of sets of resources. So that would be a similar definition for functions of on the power set of R. And it just follows the same methodology. So here we would have that obviously S being ordered relative to T implies that the value of this set of resources is greater or equal than value of the other set of resources. It's analogous. Okay, I'll skip this. Any questions on this kind of more general part of the talk? Oh, that's the power set. So this would be the set of all subsets of resources.
Way back when you defined the properties of R free, did you really mean to say R free star R free was the power set of R free on the bottom line of the second board?
No, because I'm basically taking the union here. So when I take the union, it's still a subset of all the resources, right? So this would be a subset of resources. Uh-huh. And then when you combine them all together into some like big set of resources, you're still within the set of resources, right?
I thought R free was a set of individual resources.
Yep, that's right.
These star operations could have lists of resources at the output.
Yeah, but so is the case. So that's when we apply them to individual resources. So that would be here. If we apply star, if we take two resources, then we can in general get a set of multiple resources. But similarly, if we take a set of resources, it would be like a set of possibilities on one side and another set of resources, then again, we just get a set of resources from them. So it would be, that basically is what I was trying to convey here.
The list of resources at the output is just considered some other set of resources.
Yes. I think, at least for now, I'm kind of thinking about it as the possibility. So if you think of this set of resources as a set of possibilities and this one as well, and you just evaluate what are all the possible resources I can obtain from a resource from S and a resource from T, and just that's still just a set of possibilities.
It seems there's a difference because suppose I could run through all the possibilities for capital, the elements of capital S owns capital T.
Yep.
And I find individual resources R1 and R2 each are in that product. Well, that doesn't mean the list R1 and R2 is something I could have gotten from combining some element of S with some element of T.
Nope.
So it seems like just saying that, okay, the output is the set is not the same as saying it's a set of lists of resources.
No, it's not the same. It could be that you can gain something by doing that, but as far as this talk, definitely, and as far as I have like gotten to, I didn't see any need for introducing that. So I'm not sure why would you do that?
Maybe it's something else you said at some point was that you could have psi tensor R as a potential.
Yeah, I just erased that. Yeah.
Yeah. And I presumed you meant in parallel as opposed to sort of this universal notion that I.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so maybe you just have your lists.
Okay. Yeah, I didn't.
What I think the lists are.
I didn't get to that, but okay. I'm thinking of. So, in particular cases, say in process theory, like say partition process theory, I would think of R star S as kind of a notion of universal composition. So something like this. As opposed to. Just R tensor S, which would be possibly an element of this. So this would correspond to, or this guy, to all the ways I could combine R and S together. So much for the colored chalk. Okay. I think that's enough for the introduction in half an hour. I will now go to the second part, which will be about the generalized cost of formation and also generalized yield functions. So in this part, I will take certain notions of monotones that appear in the literature, in particular resource theories, and try to generalize them into this kind of abstract framework and see what's the most general sense in which these functions are monotone. So in particular, the cost of formation and the yield function. So the first one, OK, to start in this whole part, I will assume f is a function from the resources to real numbers and is not a monotone for now. So this is just a function. And I will also use a set S, subset of resources, which will be a downward closed subset of resources, as I have defined it here. And now, some color. So first of all, I will define define the generalized cost of formation. So the generalized cost of formation, or what I called the F cost of formation relative to S. Relative to S. So this is going to be a function. Let's call it sigma sub f with a prescript s. It depends on the this choice of this function and the downward closed subset. This would be a function from resources to real numbers, again, defined by the following. So the value of resources according to this function, so applied to R, is defined through some optimization procedure. It will be the infimum of all the values of resources according to this function, which is not a monotone, just any function, F applied to S. But what are these resources that we are evaluating and optimizing over? These are all the resources that, if we combine them with resources in our downward closed S, we can possibly obtain our resource of interest, R. So this would be all the S such that R can be obtained from S, the capital S, the downward closed subset, and the small s. Maybe the notation is not ideal, but this is what I mean. Yes, that's what I mean. Does the definition make sense?
And the infimum is over all small s and r.
Yeah, so this would be over all small s. And similarly, we would define, so this would be the F yield. I won't write it all down, but it will be a similar function which would be defined in this way. So it will be lambda. Again, it depends on F and S, and its value is now going to be a supremum, also over resources in R. And the supremum will be over the values of function F applied to S. But now, instead of optimizing over resources that we can use to create R by means of S, we will now optimize over all the resources we can obtain from R by means of S again. So there will be all the S which satisfy that we can possibly obtain them from R by combination with the capital S. I think I'm getting a bit small in my writing, but makes sense.
So in the entanglement versions of these, there's limits and there's, you know, you have many, many copies of state.
This is the regularized version, but there's also the single shot version.
So this is more of a single shot.
Yep.
Okay.
But then, of course, you can consider the kind of a large copy limit, and you will get a new order. You'll get different definitions.
Okay. Yeah. I was just trying to get my head on straight.
Yeah, yeah. If you're but in terms of analogy, you should think of this as single shot.
Single shot. Okay. Okay.
Yeah, so these are the two functions. And now the upshot of this is that these guys are monotones. So in particular, for any choice of a function of resources, a real valued function of resources, and any choice of a downward closed subset, of which there are many, as I explained here, you get a monotone by actually two monotones, one for the cost and one for the yield. There's no assumption on F, it's any function.
Is it because you picked S to be downward closed and realized that it wouldn't be? Could you have constraint on F, but S not be downward closed?
I haven't encountered that. I don't think optimizing over non-downward closed sets gives you anything, even if F would be in monotone, for example. I don't think so. Especially if I think about the proof, I don't think it would go through, even if F is monotone. Yeah, so as Jamie pointed out, there are some examples of this, for example, in the resource theory of entanglement. So this would basically correspond to what's called the entanglement of formation. And entanglement of formation, the way it's usually presented, is constructed as a convex roof quantity. So you take the entanglement entropy, which is only monotonic for the pure states, and then you use the convex roof construction to extend it to all states. And in fact, there is a connection between this construction and the convex roof method, which I will not go into in this talk because I don't have time. But if you are interested, feel free to talk to me later. There's a sense in which this construction can be thought of as a generalization of the convex roof method. OK, so I'll skip the convex roof because I don't think there will be enough time for that. And it's a bit technical as well. Are there any questions about these two guys?
Is one always bigger than the other, like in entanglement?
Only when this guy is monotone. I think when F is monotone, then yes, should be the case. So there's one thing which I didn't say. So this is not the most general version of these theorems. You can also relax F to be just a function of some subset of resources, like in the entanglement, where you would have a entanglement entropy defined only on subset of resources, not all the resources, or only some particular class of states. And this still goes through. There's some extra bits that need to be added, but it's not too bad. And another thing, you can also have a function of sets of resources. And then these constructions would give you a monotone in this sense, a monotone for sets of resources as well, kind of analogous. And there's one other way in which you can generalize these constructions, and that would be related to what I will talk about now, which are the K-monotones. So there's a version of these for K-monotones as well, but I haven't introduced those, so okay.
I just wondered, like, if one's not bigger than the other, you could always get this weird, like, the proof for entanglement's quite easy. You have a bunch of maximally entangled states, then you create some other state, and then you should not be able to use that state to create more entanglement.
Yep.
So, you keep turning the crank, you should not get more entanglement.
Yeah, but that relies on the notion that this, what you call entanglement, is kind of a valid measure of the resource that is monotone. Otherwise, there's no reason why you shouldn't be able to do that.
So you don't get anything weird happening when one's not bigger than the other?
No, it's just that the measure, so to speak, the measure you started with is not a real measure of resourceness.
Yeah,
right?
I see.
But if it actually is, then you do get this property.
If f itself is not an arbitrary function, but is itself a monotone of any kind, then is it true that the cost of formation and the cost of, and the f yield are always equal to the value of f on the resource as opposed to on anything in the set?
Yes. So in particular, if you had monotone, which would be defined on all resources, then by doing this construction, you will not get anything else. You'll just get back the same monotone. But it's possible that maybe you have a monotone which is defined on a subset or some subspace of resources. And then this gives you something non-trivial. It extends that monotone to all resources. OK. There are no more questions about this part. Maybe I can move on to the K-monotones part and talk about the resource weight and resource robustness. So this was not completely general, but a little bit more general. In particular, I didn't assume anything about star apart from what I talked about before. In the next part, so three, about K-monotones, I will only use the case where the example that I erased, so that will be the example where star is just the standard composition of resources and conversions or states and channels and so on. And the reason for that is that it's simpler. And there are also, I think there are some details which are still not clear to me in the general case. So I will leave that for later, not for this talk. So first of all, okay, here's the yellow. It will be a definition of a K-monotone. And K is a natural number here, but natural numbers can be big. So this will only be for two monotones. So a function, let's give it a label 2 to remind us that it's supposed to be a two monotone. It takes two resources. Being a bit sloppy here, but let's say it takes any two resources and gives a value to them. So it's a function that assigns values to pairs of resources as opposed to just resources. We would say that this function, you know, here is a two monotone if what? So now there's some choice in the way you define this notion. And I will use the following one. There's also other ways you can do it, and you will get just a different notion, but of course. And so the way I will define is that the function is non-increasing in this sense of the value of R and S is greater or equal than the value of some conversion applied to R, psi, and some conversion applied to S. And in particular, notice that these two are the same conversion. And this should be the case for all resources R and S in R, and for all conversions which are free, so all psi in R free. So in this sense, it seems like the definition of one monotone, but note that this is not. It is not the following. R above, say, R primed, and S above S primed implying that F2 of R and S is greater than or equal than F2 of R primed S prime, right? So this is a different notion, in particular because here I take psi to be the same on both. And similarly, you can also define K monotones, where K would be the number of resources you are evaluating, the basically the length of the string. So this, in particular, what I want to emphasize, the fact that we have defined it like this, it means that we are thinking of these pairs of resources not as in the sense of pairs of resources like elements of this power set. They are not two distinct possibilities. It's more like they. Why am I saying this? I don't think that's correct. Okay, forget that. I'm not sure what I was trying to say.
How do you handle K non integer?
Sorry?
When K is non integer, how do you handle it?
I haven't thought about that. Do you think you can?
Well, you said K was real.
Oh, did I?
Yeah. No, it's okay.
Yeah, K is an integer.
Okay.
Yeah. So one particular example of this kind, which appears a lot, is, for example, in this case of two monotones, would be a distance measure. So you can have a distance evaluates pairs of elements, say pairs of resources. And if this distance measure is also monotonic, then it would satisfy this. Many times we have distance measures which are so-called contractive. And contractive distance measures would be the ones which are monotonic, but not only under the free operations, but monotonic under all the operations, all the channels, say. Contractions in quantum theory would be non-increasing under all channels. So then the significance of these contractions is, for example, that in particular, any resource theory which you obtain from that enveloping theory of resources, these measures of distance will be monotones, regardless of your choice of the free sub theory. And then, okay, so I will just erase this.
It would be two monotones.
Sorry? I mean, in some sense, this prefix two monotone is a little bit redundant. It just reminds you that the function evaluates pairs of resources. And regarding to this K monotones, there is also a way to convert, say, K monotone to M monotones, where M monotones, where M should be, okay, let's say, strictly smaller than K. So if we have a function that evaluates K tuples of monotones and K tuples of resources and N is monotonic, then we can obtain from it, in particular, not just one, but many functions which evaluate m tuples of resources. And that's what the next result is going to say. Use a red color. So we, okay, I don't have that much time. So maybe I'll just do this. Okay, I'll just write it down in full. I'll see how far I get. So F2 is going to be a two monotone. Maybe I should. S in R is a downward close. It's downward close like before. And then the following function of just resources, not pairs of resources. So f, say f1, defined on the resources in the following way. It is going to be an infimum, and how does this work? Infimum over all the values of f2 on pairs R and S, and it's optimized over all the resources small s in the downward closed set capital S, like so. So you can see examples of this in measures of resources in quantum theory. There's a lot of those. You take a distance measure that's contractive usually or just monotonic. You optimize over one of its arguments over the set of, usually you take S to be the set of free resources. So you optimize, say, over the free states in the trace distance, and what you get is a monotone. Okay, I didn't finish the statement, sorry. This function is, you can say explicitly, one monotone. Any questions about that?
So you don't have to assume that S is free.
Nope. S can be any of these downward closed subsets.
Why is it important for it to be downward closed?
It's important because, well, I can show you the proof and you will see. But also is the fact that we need to be able, like when we apply a free operation on R, we need to be able to basically pull it back to S, and the S should not get bigger by applying free operations. So that's basically what the condition here says, that if you combine S with free operations, it doesn't get bigger.
Yeah,
and that provides you with the bounds. Okay. Yeah. So in particular, in the case when this two monotone F2 that you started with is a contractive distance measure, this construction would give you a notion of minimal distance from S of R according to that distance measure. And this minimal distance, if that original distance measure was contractive, is also going to be a monotone. Yeah, that's basically the kind of idea that this generalizes. Okay. Unfortunately, it seems like I don't have that much time left. Okay, I think I have enough time to talk about the resource weight and robustness, and I will skip the last part, which is a bit tangential anyway, the kind of distinction between good and bad monotones. I'll skip that. I wanted this picture. Okay, what's going on? I'm gonna erase. Okay, no one's gonna read this anyway. So now, in the particular case of resource theories where this space of all resources has some extra structure, and this extra structure is a convex structure, there are some more interesting things we can say in relation to, for example, this result here, which also, by the way, can be generalized to this case here. I just wrote it for the case of two monotones. Okay, so this would be the weight and robustness. So in this part, we will have to assume that R has a convex structure. And not just that, also if R is of the kind as I have said I'm only considering, so there's going to be, say, state and channels, then we want those channels, so R conv, the conversions are convex linear. They respect the convex structure. So under these two assumptions, we can actually write down some monotones which will apply in all of these resource theories, and they make use of that convex structure. So first of all, I will start with a free monotone. So that's going to be this function. So there's, I will call it M, is a function of free tuples of resources. And it evaluates them in the following way. The value of M on R, S and T is going to be either lambda. If these free resources or conversions, whatever, are aligned, so to speak, R is a convex combination of S and T, lambda s plus 1 minus lambda t, and we want it to be convex, not affine. So lambda is in 0, 1. And if it's not the case that r, s, and t are aligned, we'll just assign this some any value that's at least 1. We can, for example, say infinity if this also includes infinity, whatever. Otherwise, so this function, I called it convex alignment because it measures when these free resources are aligned in a convex way. This function is a free monotone. And that follows basically from this assumption of convex linearity of the convergence. So anytime these two are satisfied, we will get this free monotone. And now we can apply this result and see what we can obtain from this function. In general, we will have to use some downward closed subsets of resources. So there might be many options of downward closed. But as I said before, there are some kind of generic downward closed subsets, which will be R and R free. So let's just see what do we get if we use R and R free in all the possible ways that we can. And so we use theorem to get one monotones. And since I don't have much time left, I'll just tease you and say that if you do that and consider all the, okay, how many combinations? Well, there's many. But there's many ways in which you can apply that theorem because, okay, I wrote it only as optimizing over the second argument, but obviously you can also optimize over the first argument and so on. If you do that for this particular function, then you get four non-trivial one monotones. One of them is going to be the resource weight. I'm not sure if Ravi, can I go over a little bit? Okay, I'll go over 5 minutes. Oh, because I'm not sure if like when I say weight, it means something to you. I'll just write it down a bit more in detail. So we'll get the weight of a resource. The resource weight, or also it's called resource fraction in some cases, would be what we get when we optimize this function m r s t. And which one is that? It's when we optimize s over the all resources and t just over the free ones. And in particular, we can write this as the infimum. OK, I'm not going to write it all down. I'll just show you on the picture. There's also the robustness. There's two other which are not so important because they often turn out to be trivial. So there's four, but in fact, in particular, the last one, anytime the set of resources is not only has a convex structure, but is also convex, this fourth one is going to be just constant. Doesn't give you anything interesting.
Do they have names?
I gave names to them, but
you could just tell me.
Yeah, so one of them is I call the free robustness, and one of them non-convexity, just because it's only non-trivial when the resource sets are non-convex. But basically, they are kind of grouped. So these two are just kind of the same, and these two are the same. So it would be like the resource weight, but with respect to the free set, not the whole set.
Can you explain what you mean by you getting 4 1 monotones? Like,
yes.
If I apply this, do I apply it to get a set of 2 monotones and then some ones?
Yep.
Or like, and also, what's my downward closed set here? Is it just R free?
Yes. So I can explain on this example here. So I wrote down explicitly what the resource weight means. So in here, I optimize over two sets, over R and R free. It's just a choice. I could choose different ones.
Okay, yeah.
And then over some of the arguments, so I optimize over R here and R for here.
So it's like robustness also the same, but optimized
yes.
over two different.
So robustness would be you optimize over R free, the free set here, and the full set here.
Okay. So, but like, why is there just 4? Is that obvious?
There's more, but many of them just turn out to be trivial. They're just constant.
Okay.
And the last thing, I'm not sure if this is going to work out, but I can try. I will just, yep.
The first one that you defined where the two downward closed sets you use are all in free. How is it possible that you can put anything in there and not get one?
In which one?
Oh, sorry. Nope, scratch that.
And just the last thing I was going to do is to show you what these four mean. So here I have, so this would be the free set of resources would be this non-convex set. I made it non-convex so that the fourth one is non-trivial. And this would be the set of all resources, the bigger set. So there's the convex structure is a plane. And let's say we want to evaluate this point, which is some resource R. Now, okay, maybe this will not make sense, but the resource weight basically can be thought of as the ratio of this length A and M weight would be A over A plus B. So it would be how much of this resource can be thought of as being free. So this guy is free, and this one is non-free. So if we decompose this resource in a convex way into a free and non-free resource, how much of it can be put into the free or non-free part, depending on whether you take the weight or 1 minus the weight. Then the robustness, let me see if I can get this. Let's take a different color. The robustness The robustness would be, I think, something like this. M rop C and D here. I think, oh, I actually wrote it down somewhere. Maybe I should use that. So this should be C over C plus D. So here we are thinking, how much can we, how much of non-free resource can we possibly add to our resource R in a convex way so that we still get a free resource here. So that would be the robustness. And the free robustness would be the same, but this guy on the edge would be free. So I think that would correspond to something like this. And the non-convexity, that's what I wanted to get to, because usually the last one on the list, because it's trivial when the free set is convex, it's usually not considered. So I just wanted to give you a flavor of what it means. So that would be the last one, the non-convexity. We see, let's say, E here. So that would be something like C over C plus E in this diagram. It basically just tells you if I want to decompose R into two free resources, what's the minimal like weight of the smaller one of those. So in particular, anything in the free set is going to have value zero. Anything that's outside of the convex hull of the free set is going to have value infinity or whatever we assign to it. And the things which are in between, so outside the free set but in the convex hull, there will be some ordering of them. And the ordering is going to respect the ordering of the resources just because the conversions are convex linear. Okay, so sorry for going over time. I'll just wrap up to say that all this is trying to find the most kind of general setting in which these kind of monotones, like we've seen there, weight and robustness, the entanglement of formation and others, what is the most general setting in which these apply? So that's what I've tried to do here. Thanks.
Is there any phrasing of this general resource theory in some topological terms, like considering the downward closed sets as like the closed sets of a particular topology?
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if you are familiar with this, but there is some literature on the not quite equivalence, but some kind of correspondences between ordered sets and topological spaces. And if you use that, then you could probably find some interpretation on that side. I haven't found anything meaningful so far, but there is something there. And another thing is that's kind of related to your question, it doesn't really answer it, but it just came to my mind, is that sometimes you actually need to assume, apart from, you also need to assume topology on your resources and the fact that these are not just downward closed sets, but actually closed in the topology as well. So there will be the two structures kind of combined together. That's kind of necessary. And obviously it's necessary when you want to actually compute these things. You want to have some closure.
I think I figured it out.
So it occurs to me that the abstract construction here will work for any notion of combining, you know, resources S and T to get a resource R, not necessarily just convex combination.
Mm.
So earlier we were talking about how in the case of many copies, we could choose to quantify how many copies we have just in terms of a scalar multiple.
Mm-hmm.
So you could say something like, R can be made out of, say, a scalar multiple lambda of S starred with you know, lambda prime t, for instance, right? So what's the kind of least quantity of s and t I need to make r? And then you can do the same sorts of tricks. Say, let's say s is in the free set, t is in the full set. I don't see how any of this would break down. And in fact, it would be more general because it would apply to theories that where r wasn't even convex.
Yeah, I think that sounds reasonable and something worth pushing.
You're not claiming you'll get any of these monotones. You're just saying you'll get out different monotones.
Right.
As you said, maybe just use the structure that's already implicitly there or explicitly. Instead of plus, use the star or some other combination operation, and also the scalar multiples.
I imagine it would probably give you the, in some choice, the normal asymptotic notion of cost. You know, how many copies of this thing do I need to make one copy of this thing when I'm allowed arbitrary numbers of copies of the free things? You know, that will come out as the usual notion.
So that could be related to Tobias's results on asymptotic conversions in the resource theories of in the theory of resource convertibility. And I think that would be related to that.
Is it true that the only property, at least the way you presented it, for a free resource, other than it being a subset, is that R free star R free is R free? Like, there's nothing other. So, like, abstractly speaking, in principle, this isn't how it's defined now, but you could just take R and a definition of your star product and ask the question, what are the subsets that satisfy R? S star S equals S.
Yeah, so there's another thing, which is, say you have some more structure on all resources.
Okay.
Then I would imagine that you would, if that structure is relevant at all, you would want that structure to be also preserved. So this would be a sub theory in the sense of whatever structure R has.
Yeah, I'm just asking, like.
So say, if you want to consider that as a category, then you would want this to be a subcategory if you want.
But like, for instance, like, is there a well-defined notion of like a minimal free set of resources? Or
I don't think there would be a unique one.
Yeah, or maybe like the fact that you could have two different, maybe disjoint free resource sets. And then like, what does it mean to talk about two different sets of orderings? And like, which ordering do you want to respect for your monotones? Can you accommodate both? That kind of stuff. Is that something you thought about?
It's something that is kind of on my mind, but I haven't like been able to do much concrete stuff with those ideas. And there's something related to that, which is any downward closed set also defines an ordering.
Right.
And
then
these monotones, which are kind of erased here, so the cost and the yield are monotones also with respect to the ordering defined by S.
Right.
And there's multiple things that there could be had there, which is in this kind of structure of resource theories for a particular space of all resources. Something like that.
Those are related,
Maybe a good example of that kind of hierarchy of free sets you could choose is in the resource theory of asymmetry. The free set could be things that are symmetric with respect to all rotations, or maybe only symmetric with respect to rotations about this axis, or maybe only symmetric with respect to pi rotations about this axis. And so that's you're allowing more and more stuff in your free set. And so there's a relationship between those resource theories that are defined relative to those free sets. And that's where this notion of downward closed set comes in, is that the ones that have that break more symmetries are downward closed relative to the ones that break fewer symmetries.
Yes, that's right.
So part of the project here is to be able to say something about that kind of structure of resource theories.
Two comments. In terms of Rob's idea where you could generalize this three monotone instead of addition to star combination. If you are considering n copies and copies of the two resources and you say, can I get there? Then there's not a unique one value if yes and infinite if otherwise. Because if you can get there with two copies of S or three copies of S or four copies of S, these are all ways that you can get there. Whereas it's sort of in the linearity, one of the things that it buys you when you have this complex structure mm-hmm. is that if you ask from these two resources, how do I get there? There's a unique solution. Whereas if you say, under star product, and I can consider any number of copies, there may not be a unique way to achieve a final resource, if it can be achieved at all.
The more relevant question there is, what's the minimal number of copies I need?
Right, so there would have to be a caveat.
Little rephrase.
But then if you have like the two sets, it's a minimum with respect to what? You have three sets.
Yeah.
I agree, it's not a big problem. You have this definition of a downward closed set. Is there a notion of an upward closed set?
Yes, I guess the terminology comes from the theory of ordered sets. And there is a notion of upward closed, it just is not relevant in any of this. The downward closed, if you have, I can just do it like quickly. If you have a lattice and you have some ordering, which is the standard ordering, say on R2, then the downward closed set, say the one generated by this point, which would be generated in this kind, would be this guy. So everything that's below the order, this is downward close, and then everything above would be the upward close. That's where the terminology comes. Oh, I don't have anything really deep to say about that. But basically, what I was going to say there is that you can order monotones relative to each other, and there's different ways you can order monotones depending on what's the consideration you want to take into account. So for example, one would be how much of the order do they capture. The monotones can somehow compress the information about the ordering of the resources, so how much of that information do they retain? Maybe the ones that retain more information are more valuable. So there's one way in which you can compare monotones in their valuableness or expressiveness of the order. But then another desideratum is how easy they are to compute, how easy they are to work with. So there's different notion of value of monotone. There I was going to talk just about the expressiveness and how you can order them based on that.
Can you have a monotone for a monotone?
Yep. I mean, once you have order of monotones, you can also have monotones for the order of monotones. You can go on.
If you have all these like multiple layers of monotones, can you just sweep up the first few layers inside the free states and just have one monotone? That's too much sweeping under the carpet.
I think, as you said, like using this monotone already, or as I said, it compresses the information. So if you're just going to higher and higher in that hierarchy, I'm not sure how much value that would give you. Using monotones again for the order in there.
Huge. Instead of having an order over lists of monotones, then the top of the order is any complete set of monotones,
yeah.
Right? So there's in many cases there's you have enough monotones, you can completely reproduce the partial order. So that would be at the top. And then at the bottom, you'd have various individual. I mean, I guess at the bottom, you'd have things that tell you nothing.
Like constant function.
Constant
function.
It's a monotone, but tells you nothing.
But you would also have sort of things that are like individual monotones that pick out different aspects, like that reduce the partial order to a total order. So there'd be lots of ways you could reduce the partial order to a total order, and that would be a bunch of distinct points in the whole ordering. And then you could also coarse grain that total order, so that would take you down to constant. So you'd have all this structure, and if somebody gives you a monotone, perhaps you could say something about how good it was, you know, like maybe it's only a single monotone, but actually the total order captures doesn't coarse grain any information, so it's as good a single monotone as you could hope for,
yeah.
So something like that.